Hello, everyone. Welcome again to another Learn Live session. I'm Glenn Stevens. I'm here with my good friend and colleague, Jason DeBuga. We're going to take you on an exciting road trip of building classical machine learning models with supervised learning today. Hey, Jason, how are you doing?
Great, Glenn. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Now, good to be back with you.
Excellent. Likewise. So I'm a senior content developer here at Microsoft. I work on mostly on the Learn Live product at the moment. Jason, do you want to introduce yourself to the lovely audience out there?
Yeah, I'm a senior product manager here at Microsoft, and I work on ML and AI content. So, of course, that's my connection here. You work mostly with Learn Live. I work mostly with ML and AI, and together, here we are.
Excellent. It's the superpowers together, hopefully. And we've got a lot of people calling in from all over the planet here as well. So we are live. Keep your messages coming through. Ask questions as we go through. But this is actually the second in a series that we're running. Today is the second on that list, build classical machine learning models. Last week we did introduction to machine learning. We had lots of people come along and listen to that, which was lovely. And we're going to be doing some more great content as we go through. This is actually just 5 of the 9 episodes that we're seeing. We're going to be looking at machine learning, regression models, testing and validating learning models, and a range of others as well.
We didn't want to put all of the modules up here because some of them would seem too intimidating in the first and second week. But by the time we get to week 5 and 6, you'll be ready.
Yeah, you will. It'll be awesome. And there's also a link on the top of the screen there as well. If you do want to download the content or just follow along with the learning path on Microsoft Learn, it's aka.ms/learnml. And all of the content that we're bringing you is actually based on existing Learn content. So you can actually just sit back and watch in your own time, experience what we're doing, and then go back and do the Learn modules. Or you can follow along if you choose to as well.
And so, by the way, all of the compute environment, all of the code is provided for you right there at those aka.ms links. Now, you'll notice the first link that Glenn read off didn't have the dash classical ML. That was for the whole learning path. This one right here, this link right here, is specifically for the module that we'll be going through and teaching today. But again, compute environment, code provided for you. You can tweak the code, you can play with it, but if you just want to follow along and do what we do, it's right there for you, all provided for free.
Excellent. Now, an interesting question we have already, Jason, is that can you please start out with the definition of supervised learning? I think we might need to do a little bit of a definition, but not a huge one because we'll get into the depths a little bit later.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely talk about what is machine learning. In fact, I think I'm going to punt on that just a few minutes and say, you know what, give us just a minute to get to the definition of supervised learning. It's something we plan to answer there. So let's first talk about what we're going to focus on today, which is what is the definition of supervised and unsupervised learning, which is why I said give us just a minute and we'll get there. As you can see, it's part of the plan. And when we're going to look at how cost functions in detail affect our learning process. And I know we talked a little bit about cost functions last week, but we're going to look at that in a lot more detail, as well as our optimizers. And you can see, actually, we're talking about gradient descent. So there's a new piece of jargon, a new glossary term for us to focus in on. That's a particular optimization. And we'll also tweak around and play with our learning rates to see how that can affect our learning process. In other words, what we're doing is peeling back the layer just a little bit on the things we did last week, that overview level last week. Does that sound about right?
It does sound about right. And don't worry if you're not comfortable with the terms yet. We'll explain them as we go through. So by the end of it, you go, okay, so what are you talking about? Yeah. Some of the knowledge builds on top of the previous knowledge. So it'll take a little bit of time to get there. But keep in mind that we are live and interactive as well. So if you have any questions, send them through to the chat. Say hello, even just a greeting. It would be lovely to hear from you wherever you are on the planet.
Absolutely. And of course, in addition to us being here to answer your questions, we have a team of amazing moderators, highly, highly skilled experts in machine learning who are on our various chat channels. Of course, we prefer that you're hanging out on the Learn TV chat channel, but some of you are on our different venues. And we've got people handling the chat and helping out there. and all those channels. And really, these people are amazing experts. So a lot of the times they're going to answer questions we wouldn't be able to answer even on a live stream right there in chat. But I do hope that they threw a few of the questions our way, because we do enjoy answering them on the stream as well. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's very true. I feel very privileged to have everyone here on the call. Awesome. So why don't we get into the content for today, Jason? Where do we want to start?
Super duper. Well, we've got our what is supervised learning, and actually just a little bit of a break before we really dive in. But I will say that supervised learning is defined as training against a correct answer. And what that means is when we have our training data, we have a known correct answer, and we're going to be using that as our measurement of what we're trying to get better at doing. We're going to try to get better at our machine learning model predicting correct answers. And that, of course, implies that there is a correct answer and that our historical data has it. But even in a broader sense, what we're going to be doing today is using supervised learning examples to dig further into the general machine learning process. So the general process of optimizing and of cost functions. That's the real benefit today, is that we're looking at the general overview, the general process at a deeper level, at a more hands-on level than we got to last week. But yeah, for sure, we will focus on some of the specifics of supervised learning. You want to tell us about the scenario we're going to use today, Glenn?
Oh, yeah, of course. So just like last week, we have a scenario that we're running through. And in this case, we're doing a scenario based on a farm that's based in Washington State. And it's an elk farm that's been held onto for a number of generations. And the farmers there had known that normally you don't feed the grain to the elk roughly when it's a bit too cold. So about 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit if we're using your American units over there, Jason. So we've followed that process, but we've noticed over time that the elk have not been responding well. We're worried that the temperatures are changing through climate change, and we want to look at that data and see if we can see where the trends are going up, for example, and see if we need to shift that date. It's an important business decision for the farm to look after the health and safety of the elk as well. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at the historical data, see where the trends are happening in a way to see if we can predict what it's going to be for subsequent years.
Super. That about covers it. So, all right. I see the question again. What is supervised learning? Does that mean I'm about to answer it? I am about to, but just not quite yet. I'm still teasing. Now, the two main types of machine learning algorithm, at least in the classic machine learning world, are supervised and unsupervised. Those are our two original categories, if you will. Now, in the last 5 or so years, it's exploded to where some things that you might hear about or read about in the press are definitely in the gray area of where they're at in terms of how they measure correctness. But we're going to really zone in on these original two types, and they're kind of original buckets so that we can keep out of the gray areas, if you will. So unsupervised, we're going to define that first so we can contrast supervised to it. Unsupervised actually is a type of machine learning algorithm where we don't have a correct answer, where we aren't measuring against some known correct value. If you think back to last week, for those of you who were with us last week, our correct answer, in other words, the thing we were trying to predict and then the thing we were able to measure against to see whether or not we had a good prediction or a bad prediction with our machine learning model, it was dog boot size, right? For our sled dogs, they had to wear boots. And we could see using historical data what the correct boot size would be. And so we were training a model to try to see how good we could get at guessing the dog's boot size. But our historical data had a boot size. That was an absolute known correct value. With unsupervised learning, we're dealing with problems that don't necessarily have a known correct. And the classic example is customer segmentation. I'll actually use a very concrete and simplified example for customer segmentation. So imagine that we have a store selling t-shirts, and we want to decide what sizes our small, medium, and large t-shirts should be, right? So what measurements, Glenn, might we have for our t-shirts? In other words, things that would be inputs to our models.
Right. We might have just the dimensions that a tailor would use, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we could have like our chest size and our shoulder width and waist size, things like this. And maybe we have that for a lot of our customers. So what we want to do is, knowing that we're only going to sell three sizes, we need to cluster. This is known as a clustering algorithm. We need to cluster those sizes so that we can find kind of the middlest ground at three different central points, so that we can have the happiest total set of people. Right. So this would be what's known as a clustering algorithm. And there's no correct answer using different cost functions. So we're going to talk a lot about cost functions today. And using different cost functions, we might come up with different best clusters. So now I'm going to use a little bit more of an abstract example, just so you can picture really in your head what I mean by these different cost functions and these different ways to come up with clusters. Imagine we just had a picture of a spiral galaxy. So you can picture that spiral galaxy. It's got its arms kind of wrapping around the kind of center point there. Now, if I wanted to slice that into, say, five or six clusters, let's say there were five or six spiral arms, there are different ways I could slice and dice that picture. I could have it be basically sliced like a pie. I could have each one of those spiral arms be a cluster. You could have just clusters that were blobs. And all of those are relatively valid answers depending on what you're trying to do with this picture of a galaxy. And so different clustering algorithms legitimately could come up with different answers to how would I cluster this scatter plot that looks like a spiral galaxy.
Yeah, so I imagine it might cluster based on the distance between the other stars or the density of a star, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And there's slightly different ways to measure that, whether you're focused on density or total distance and things like that, right? So exactly. But all of that becomes a matter of cost function. And so we could have the same entire other process, but then the cost function of how you measure density versus distance or things like their total distance, that's going to drive what ends up coming out as our final answer. So that's unsupervised learning. Now, back to supervised learning, I think we may be, those of us who were here last week will realize that this is much closer, the supervised learning where we have a answer to what we did when we had our doggy boots. So that's exactly what we're going to be focusing on again. In terms of most of our classic models, that we're going to deal with throughout this course, it's going to be our primary focus. So we're going to do things like regression and classification, where we can train against data, where we know what class it belongs to, what category it belongs to. Or with regression, like our boots, we can tell what number we're trying to get out of it. So that's going to be most of our focus, but we're still going to see that our different cost functions can matter.
Awesome.
What do we do with our labels, Glenn? How do those come in? Our labels for training and actually, I jumped ahead because I asked you what do we do with our labels, and I didn't really zone in on this yet, did I?
No, not quite.
Because there's a little bit more jargon.
well, I think understanding the jargon is really useful because there is a lot of terminology. And even last week, I think we mentioned that you'll find that some of the terminology will be used in statistics, in machine learning, and in other fields as well. So if you feel like you'd like to understand a term a little bit more, let us know. We'll explain a little bit more too. We've got a question in the chat as well. Is there any way to estimate the performance of unsupervised learning models? It's a great question.
Yeah. So I think again, it's gonna depend on the definition of the word performance, which always is going to be very related to our cost functions. So the answer is our metrics that are important to us are not always the same as our cost functions. but it's definitely related, right? So we use a cost function to try to estimate what we really care about in the real world. And one could argue that a clustering cost function for, say, our t-shirt sizes, will itself give us the interim performance metric, but the real metric we're going to end up caring about, I guess, is going to be our satisfied customers. How satisfied are our customers with the t-shirts we select? That's ultimately the metric we're going to look at. And if in the future of selling our t-shirts, we realize that we have less satisfied customers, we're going to need to go back and revisit all the systems we use to estimate how happy we expected them to be, including our machine learning algorithm.
Yeah, and keep in mind, we'll also be revisiting that area in later sessions too, where we're measuring the performance of a model.
All right, so the jargon point here that we talked about, features and labels. So features, we called inputs last week, and they're really the things we're going to be sending in. So last week we had our harness size. This week, I think we're going to have year or date more generically as our input for most of our examples. And labels are our outputs or what we're trying to guess. And in fact, labels are actually the correct answers in our training data for the thing we're trying to guess, even more specifically, right? So when we run our models training, the thing we compare against, the correct answer we compare against, is known as the label. And now we get to, what do we do with the labels after we're done training?
But we actually don't need the labels once we've done the training. It's really for those examples, like you said. Supervised learning is where you know the right answer and you use that in order to train. So it's important during the training process, but not when you're executing the model.
Exactly. So remember, as we talked about last week, that our training process is part of our development cycle. So we train a model when we're developing our application. If our model is going to be part of our application, we have to train it before the application is not ready until we have a trained model. So even though we execute code and we use our historic data with labels during that training process is part of the development loop. And so once we're done with that, once we're deploying our app along with the completed model, we don't need that historic data and we don't need to know the correct answers anymore. It's now going to be our model's job to give us those answers, or at least their best guesses at those answers. So look at this. We've got a lab coming up, a heads down coding time. Maybe not heads down for us, because we still have to talk to folks about what we're doing, but maybe heads down for them when they go to work on it.
That's very true. And there's a few things we'll be going through in this exercise as well. We'll be looking at selecting a model. We'll look at the cost function again. It's an important thing. We'll look at the optimizer and the optimizer's loop or the training loop and show you how to basically create a simple model. And remember, we're using the classical format. So it's going to be slightly similar to what we did last week, Jason, don't you think? But we're kind of controlling it. We're not using a library like we did.
That's right. The main difference is going to be we're going to be focused on some code that we have right there in our Jupyter notebook instead of calling into a library to do the work for us. Now, of course, simplified, we wouldn't exactly sell our implementation as a production library. It's quite simplified, but it allows us to see what's really going on under the hood, which is wonderful, because you're going to need to understand that if you want to start debugging and revising models in the future, even when you're using a library to build the initial model.
All right, cool. Well, let's get into it. So I've got my Jupyter notebooks here running and I've activated my sandbox. If you're following along, feel free to activate yours as well. And we've got a few things that we're doing here. We're going to be filtering some data, looking at that weather situation that we have with the elk farm, where we want to look at January. We want to see if January is actually changing from year to year. And we have some historical data as well. We have this CSV file that has all the data years, I think from about 1948 to 2017. A lot of data there, which is pretty important. And then we're going to start filtering on the date, and we'll only get the entries that are within the month of January, and then we'll output the data.
Take a look. First,
let's have a quick look. It'll take a few seconds to execute. It's all exciting stuff. But this is very, very similar.
We're about to see that data.
Yeah, and we'll just scroll down.
At the bottom, we got a nice big chunk of it.
Yeah, and thanks for the Pandas Library for omitting all those records. We don't want to scroll through, 25,000 records. But it's displaying it in a nice, friendly format for us, at the very least. So we've got all that data. We've got the shape of it here, the date, the amount of precipitation, the max temperature, the minimum temperature. So we'll probably look at things like the miniature temperature for our model in today's session. But it's always a good idea to have a look at the data and see the shape. And if you can, visualize it too, to understand.
We got a comment from Musa who came up with a nice mnemonic for remembering features and labels. So PHILO, features inputs, labels outputs. Thanks, Musa.
That's good.
PHILO.
Yes, I have a fear of missing out of not remembering PHILO. That's really good. Excellent. So the next thing we want to do with the data is we want to look at the January temperatures and look at it over time. And you can actually see the minimum temperatures are steadily increasing in this chart as well, which is, I think, very useful. Any thoughts on that, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, we can plainly see by looking at it for more than a second. Maybe if you look at it for a very quick second, they might look fairly flat. But we start to see that slight upward trend pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And so this is a good sign that we might want to think about that grain feed schedule. We might be on the right track.
That's right. It looks like this year was a particularly cold year, but otherwise it's going up. Slowly but steadily.
Yeah.
Awesome. So what we want to do here is look at the values again. Like you can see here, machine learning works better when the X and Y axis have roughly the same range of values. And we'll look at areas like normalization in another session in this series. But here we want to look at the data. I'll just go ahead and run this cell.
Yeah, we'll spend a lot more time on normalization and why it's such a good idea in a future module. I think it's actually either next week or the week after that we start to look. But we wanted to do it now because one of the things, for one thing, you're going to do it all the time. And the thing that we're going to immediately observe is that even though we've changed those ranges, if you look down at the bottom, it says years since 1982, we've now normalized around a zero. So it's basically years before and years after, but the temperature is in the same boat, right? We've got some normalization there, which basically just means that we've put everything on the same rough scale and centered it around zero. But the pattern, look at the pattern, is exactly the same. If we saw that pattern when we had the normal numbers, we see the pattern now. It's exactly the same. What that means is when we think about what we're doing with these trend line linear regressions, we're going to get the same trend line. If we put a line through that data that's the best fit, it's going to be the best fit in both. So by normalizing this, we haven't messed with what the best fit is going to be for our parameters for our parameters. So for our slope and for our intercept.
Cool. And Nate has a question. And we did mention if there's a term you want to understand, let us know. Nate's done that. Thank you, Nate. The question is, what is normalization? Good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. It might be a little bit of a slippery slope to go down, and we do have another module for it. But stated briefly, it's to make consistent our data. And here we've made it consistent by centering around zero and putting our distributions on approximately the same scale. So we're not going from -3,000 to +3,000 on one axis and from 0.02 to 0.2 on the other axis. So they're on same order of magnitude and in the center around zero in this case. But basically it means to make normal, if you will, but to apply some sort of standardization or some sort of normalizing. I guess I'm begging the term there, but to put it on a standard scale.
Cool. Thanks. Thanks, Nate, and thanks, Jason, for answering.
And we'll talk about why we would do that. Maybe we'll even have a little time to touch on it at the end of exercise 3 today. But if we don't, we have a whole module for it.
Okay. Excellent. Well, let's keep going. So the next thing we're going to look at is the model. So In this particular exercise today, we're going to do something slightly different. So in last week's exercise, we used an existing library to create the model. In this particular case, we're going to create our own class that represents the model. So we'll have a class called MyModel. It'll have an initialization. We'll be using the slope and intercept just like before in last week's. So remember that y equals mx plus b chart that we're using. We'll use that same ordinary least squares algorithm, and we'll also have a prediction value. So we can pass in a date and then determine, once we know what the slope is and interception after training, we'll be able to predict future values potentially and work out what next year's weather is going to be. So let me go ahead, Jason.
As you said, this is essentially just applying that same slope and intercept, and we can see literally predict uses that mx plus m times x plus b. So your input, your input times your parameter plus your bias or your intercept. So your other parameter. So yep, awesome. Mx plus b with m being your input there.
Cool. So we've got that model created. The next step here is we're going to display the data again. So it's going to show the trend line this time, but you can see the trend line is just a flat line at zero. And the reason for that is that we haven't trained the model yet. Once we train the model, we should be able to determine what the slope is going to be, what the intercept is going to be over time. So that's our model value currently. Let's go ahead. And
Rodrigo's question. Rodrigo wants to know how many years before or after zero should we be considering? And the basic answer to this question is as much good data as you have. There is some nuance to that we'll learn more and more about as we talk about things like data cleansing, especially in next week's module. But the short answer is as many years as you have good data for, go ahead and feed it into the system. More data. The general rule is more data is better data as long as it's clean.
Awesome.
As long as it's accurate.
So the next step we're going to do is actually implement a cost function or the objective function. What is it that we're trying to measure here? And in this particular case here, we've got the estimated temperature minus the actual temperature. So we want to see the differences in the temperature to what we predict versus what's there historically, and use that in order to train the data to adjust what that intercept is going to be, to adjust what that slope is going to be.
Absolutely.
Would that be a fair statement, Jason?
I think you said it perfectly. Yep, we're going to, as we're doing a training process, need to know how wrong we are, so that we can get better. And this right here defines wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Which is awesome. So, what's the cost of it? Like, how expensive is this? How big a mistake are we making in our training in order to train the data better? So that particular step was actually just defining a method for the cost function. It wasn't actually doing the work just yet. And the next step here is where we're going to implement the optimizer. So the optimizer, we have a class here that we'll use that we've written. If you scroll up to the very start of this unit in the module, you'll actually see a class we've created called MyOptimizer, which allows you to do essentially the heavy calculus that works out where we should change, right?
And by the way, the calculus isn't that heavy, but it does do the calculus, and we're going to implement that in our third exercise today. But we'll take this little bits at a time. So for right now, we've just got that method call to do it for us.
Excellent. So and then we've got the ability to train and at least do one iteration based on some model data. So our next method here is called train one iteration. It's got the model inputs, the actual temperatures, and essentially what it's going to do is use the model to predict the value and then see how wrong it is. And based on how wrong it is, adjust the values so we can get to what should be a closer value. That's the fundamental of it. So again, this is really just defining a method again to train one iteration. We haven't actually started training just yet. Well, let me go ahead and run that cell.
Yeah, while you do that, I will talk through what it's already executed. I'll still talk. We can see that in this, while there's a bunch of comments, other than that, there's very little code. And that code that is in this loop is actually calling the methods that we already defined, which we know are also relatively small. So we've got our model predict, which is making a prediction based off of an untrained model now. So everything's zeros. Of course, it's not going to work very well. Then we use that cost function to see how badly we did. Then, we use the optimizer and the knowledge of how badly we did to get an update for our parameters. And then finally, we update our slope and our intercept parameters, and then we could try again. Actually, can you scroll down a little bit so we can see the result of the first run?
Well, it hasn't actually run it. It's really
just defining the method.
Just yet. But you're very close. In fact, the next method here is where we train one iteration based on that model. And once we train it, we'll actually output the intercept and the slope again. So if I go ahead and run this, we should actually be able to see the output. This is what it was before, 0, 0, before training. And then after training, we can see that we've adjusted the slope here a little. And in fact, if I keep clicking on this particular cell, I can see that
we keep updating those parameters.
Yeah. So if I want to train the model 4,000 times, I'm not going to click on this button 4,000 times, Jason. I'm going to put this in a loop, and then that sounds
like a better way to do it.
Yeah. Let's automate where we can. So the next block of code is really doing that. It's just running through that loop, essentially training the model with more and more data, with all the data that we have based on the historical data, and then just saying, here's what we think the intercept and the slope will be at the end of that time. And then we'll show that visually so we can see if it matches what we expect of that data over time. So there's the training. It's beginning. We've done 4,000 iterations. And now we can see that the trend line based on that historical data, and that trend line looks a lot better than the flat line at 0 that we saw before.
It sure does.
Yeah.
That looks like something that actually might do a good job of predicting our temperature.
Cool. And in theory, we could just go, well, what's going to be the next value for next year and put that into the model, predict value once we've trained the model and actually get our result, right?
Outstanding.
Cool. So that's a look at setting up a simple model using classical techniques. Any other thoughts, Jason, before we head back to the slides?
No, I think this is a good time to get back to the slide and continue talking about cost functions. It's really one of our more important topics today.
Cool. And also feel free for everyone in the audience to send us through questions like you've been doing.
Yes, it's been fantastic. Love the engagement. Love the good questions and good suggestions. All right, cost functions. We've talked about them a lot. We're going to talk about them a lot more. They are absolutely vital in getting to the correct answer because they tell us in what ways we're wrong. And we actually spent a little bit more time talking about in the unsupervised learning example than say if you read through the module. We actually are pretty quick on it. But I thought for this live session, it'd be really nice to expand on the cost function during that unsupervised section because it plays really well with what we're doing now, with what we're doing right here, which is talking about how we can change and affect the progress of what we're doing by changing the cost function, by using a slightly different cost function. We can get fairly drastically different results. And when we go further into machine learning and get into things like deep learning, different cost functions, fairly elaborate cost functions, can actually be used to do amazing things because our mathematic basis still applies. As long as we can put all of our inputs into features and then define some cost function that defines that the cost function will be satisfied or minimal when we're happy with the result. If we can somehow mathematically define happy, then we can optimize towards that goal, and we can do all sorts of things. That's where you see like these algorithms that do painting, or these algorithms that can play Pac-Man better than you can. It actually comes down to elaborately defined cost functions, believe it or not. Now we're not going to get into that level of sophistication for our linear regression talk today, but I wanted you to understand that that's why cost functions are so vital. Now, by the way, cost error and loss, they do have subtly different definitions in different contexts. In general, we're going to use them interchangeably. The thing that's maybe most universally applied is that for a full run, for a full model run, we'll say cost. But you might see loss used for individual records, or you might occasionally see that used for cost as well. So mostly they're used interchangeably, and you don't need to worry about embarrassing yourself if you use those three terms interchangeably in a discussion with just about anyone. And remember, the whole idea is that if we can minimize our cost, then as we define the definition of cost, then we're going to be able to train that model. And for this particular chart right here that we just saw a little while ago, we defined minimum cost as the total length for all of these dots towards the trend line. So actually the mean, but total or mean is going to come out to the same thing. And that's what we optimized toward. We wanted the minimum distance for each dot to the trend line. And that's what we got when we got that curve right there. Or slope, rather, right there. Glenn, anything to add there?
No, yeah, I think that's a fair call. I was actually looking at Rodrigo's question in the chat that he sent through. Where is define the total loop counts? Which was a question from the previous exercise. No, that's all right. Rodrigo, the total loop count isn't set. It's not an individual value. It's actually going through all the data from that data set in the CSV file, and it's just outputting the number every 400 records. But when it gets to the end, that's when it stops.
It actually did go through the data multiple times as well. It went through all the records multiple times. It did. We'll actually see these again. So we'll try to get back to it. All right. So let's get ready to jump into our next demo here. We have actually defined this pretty well already. What is a cost function? So I don't think we need to belabor it just because we have another slide. Let's get into that demo. Like I said, we definitely talked ahead when we focused on some of the cost function part of the unsupervised learning and the clustering algorithms earlier. All right, yet another demo. What are we going to do now?
Well, we're actually going to look at the cost functions, and we'll actually compare multiple cost functions to see where a cost function may differ and what you can do about it. So that there's a few things. We'll compare the cost functions, and then we'll look at the differences in action in a little bit more depth.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to point out to everyone that, of course, this is a lot. There's new jargon. There's new concepts. This is why we're going through a module that already exists for self-service. We're giving you an overview. We're walking through it with you. But absolutely, you should visit again and plan to do this again. You should definitely plan to go through this content again by yourself, execute the code. Hey, look for where the loop definition is in that algorithm and understand all of it yourself. Look up the definitions of the words we're throwing at you, because yes, we're throwing a lot of it at you very quickly.
Awesome. Good point, Jason. All right. Well, let me just share my screen. We'll jump into the next exercise.
Fantastic.
All right. And all right. So this one, like I said before, we're actually going to look at the data again, but we're going to look at some different cost functions that we're operating. We'll look at the kinds of relationship a model has as well. And we'll also set up some different data structures here too. So again, we're doing something very similar to the first exercise where we're loading the data. That's what we'll do here. In fact, I'll just run that cell. It might take a little bit of time. Again, we're reading from that same CSV file. And here we're also creating a new column in the data as well called year. And this is actually looking for the midpoint for the year as well. So we don't have to use the year exactly. What do you think about that particular approach, Jason? Is that sensible, you think?
Yes. In this case, what we're doing is we're turning that into a single number that we can then chart and treat as a single number by turning it into a decimal. We have a now continuous value representing our date, representing our time, instead of having two different fields or multiple fields that wouldn't be able to have a trend line as accurately.
Right. Exactly. Now, also in this exercise, we're also capturing some desired dates. So we're going to look at the dates in 10-year increments, 1950 all the way through to 2010, and then also 2017, probably to represent something closer to 2020. And then we'll copy that data, and then we'll also print that data set out. So if I scroll through that towards the end, we can see we have the data just for those particular years.
And now, as for that part, why are we cherry picking a few records? The truth is, this part doesn't necessarily fit into our scenario. What it does fit into is the point we're going to try to make about cost functions during this exercise, and having less data makes it easier for us to kind of crash the car, if you will. with more data, it's a more adaptable process, and we'd need to train for a long time to run into problems. We're trying to demonstrate quickly, so we're going to use a very small amount of data, which will allow us to run into the problems quickly for demonstration purposes. Understand that even with a lot of data, these are things that can apply.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So let's have a look at the two cost functions. And in fact, you can see them here, the sum of square differences and the sum of absolute differences. So they're very similar. They're using the same inputs, which is the estimate and output, but they're using different formulas. One's using the sum of squares, and the other one's using the absolute differences between the numbers. So subtracting the estimate from the actual in the terms of absolute differences, and then getting the absolute value there, or the sum of squares, where it's getting the estimate and actual, squaring that value, and then summarizing those particular values here as well. So let's go ahead and run that. That's really just going to, just define the particular methods in this particular case.
So these are essentially going to be our two different cost functions that we're going to compare and contrast here.
Right. And we've got we have some simple examples. So we've got an array here for the actual, which is 1 and 3, and the estimate, which is 2 and 2. So we use those as inputs to the both of those values, and then actually see how they compare. So in this particular case, there's actually not too much difference, but we've had an error of 1 for each estimate. So if we change the values slightly, we'll actually see that there's a difference between the sum of squares and the sum of the absolute values. And Jason, we were talking previously, not in this session, but before, about the differences between sum of squares and absolute differences and the impact that might have on data. Do you want to speak to that again?
If you're able to scroll it just enough so that I can see both of those input boxes on screen, I'll talk to both of those. So if we look at that first input box, and we've had the same two cost functions here, right? The first one, where our errors are between 1 and 2, if you look at the actual and the estimate, right? So the first index, or zeroth index, I suppose, we have 1 and 2, and the difference there would be -1. And that is going to square to 1. 3 minus 2 is 1, and that squares to 1. Add those together and we get 2. So the sum of squared differences is 2. For the sum of absolute differences, now in this case, this is where we just take the absolute value of the difference. So 1 minus 2 is -1. The absolute difference is 1, or the absolute value of that is 1. 3 minus 2 is 1. The absolute value is 1. So again, they sum to 2. So for that case, we have this exact same error difference. Now, by the way, why not just sum of differences? The answer is because if we had one that was -1 and one that was +1, we wouldn't want them to cancel each other out to sum to 0 and make it look like there was no error. So what we do is we have two different possible techniques at play here that will basically get rid of negatives. So sum of squares, sum of absolutes, both cancel out the negatives and give us a magnitude that we need to correct for. Now, what happened in the second example, though, is 1 minus 1 is 0. That squared is 0. And 3 minus 2 is 2. That squared is 4. Those total to 4. For our absolute difference, 0 and 2 again. But we're just going to absolute those to 2, add them up to 2. So we have 4 and 2. What this is telling us is that the sum of squared differences has the effect of magnifying outliers, or of magnifying the distance. As the distance gets greater in absolute terms, it actually gets even greater still, because we're squaring, it's literally exponential, the differences. So using the square error has the effect of exacerbating outliers. And we'll see what that means in very concrete terms, but I wanted to walk through these examples.
Yeah, and Nate has a question from the chat as well. How do we get to the two cost functions, the sum of squares and the sum of the absolute values? But from my take, those are actually pretty consistent mechanisms for evaluating cost in statistics. So imagine that we're just using that, right?
Yeah, the reality is that right now we're using some examples that have been around for literal centuries to keep things, you know, to keep things, we're at that intro level. And so the actual linear regression or ordinary least squares that we're using is something that's been around for centuries in statistics. We now claim it in machine learning, but it predates machine learning, and so do these particular cost functions. The idea is literally just to get the difference and then make sure we have no negatives. So we want the magnitude of the difference without a sign.
Awesome. So let's actually go ahead and execute that training like we did before, but this time we'll actually be able to see the difference with the cost functions. So we'll first off run by using the sum of squares.
So by the way, that Microsoft custom linear regressor, that is just exactly what we defined in the last exercise. So nothing creepy or magical going on there. Just what we did last time.
Right. So we're just training the model and then we're plotting it as well to see what happens. Now, if I look at that data, then it looks like the trend line is going up for that. But it also, like you were saying before, the squaring it really exaggerates some of the core values. So in 1950, we had a really cold year. So that value is even more exaggerated. So the trend line is slightly going up here, which is kind of interesting, because I think if I remove that 1950 value, I would imagine the trend line looks like it could be going down.
Yeah, totally agree. It looks like it might even be going down a little bit without 1950, but man, it's going sharply up, or fairly sharply up with that 1950 value in there and with us using the squared difference.
All right, cool. So that's the sum of the squares. Let's have a look at the absolute differences now. We'll go ahead and run that. And this is going to use the sum of absolute differences cost function, where the previous one was using the sum of squares. And this one looks a little bit more accurate. So it's slightly going up, but that 1950 year isn't pulling the whole thing down to the extent it was before.
Yeah, I think we can probably imagine here that 1950 is still having an influence because it's still a bigger difference. And I mean, it's still going to pull down in some level harder than everything that's closer. It's because we're still trying to minimize this distance, but we haven't made that an exponential difference in this case, because we're using just the absolute value of the difference, right?
That's right. And keep in mind, we're also using data points from every 10 years. If we had every single year, then that line would probably be a little bit more reflective of what's really happening.
Right. And that goes back to my earlier point about look, we cherry picked some data here, some small, although it's cherry picked, it's still actually representative because it's every 10 years. It's not like we picked only some really dirty values. So they're real values. And you can really see that with a smaller data set, we exacerbate the problem. And with of course, the non-optimal selection of cost function. It's worth pointing out that generally speaking, practitioners regard the squared error as a more safe choice than the absolute error, but it's not always, and you have to experiment with your models and with your data prep.
Excellent, good point. Awesome. So that takes us through the end of this section, looking at the cost functions, just so we can compare the differences to our values based on the formula that we're using. And so it's really quite an important thing to get the cost function right for your model that you're using. Any other thoughts before we jump back to the slides, Jason?
No, let's jump back. In fact, it's actually time for our game show round.
Oh, knowledge checks. Love it.
So everyone gets to play along at home at aka.ms/learnlivetv and use the chat to test your knowledge.
Excellent. Now we've got a few questions. Jason, I'm going to ask you the questions if that's okay.
Please do.
All right. Awesome. Question one, what is the difference between supervised learning and unsupervised learning? I feel like we've gone through this a few times, so I think our listeners might
have given our opinion on this, huh?
Yeah. So, is it A, supervised learning requires human supervision where unsupervised learning doesn't? Is it B, supervised learning always uses an optimizer, but unsupervised never does? Is it C, supervised learning trains a model by comparing estimates to correct answers. The cost function for unsupervised learning doesn't need correct answers.
So let's see, is it supervised learning requires human supervision? No, it has nothing to do with a human just standing and watching the model train. Supervised learning uses an optimizer, but unsupervised never does. That's not true. And everybody uses an optimizer. And supervised learning, everybody uses the optimizer. Supervised learning trains a model by comparing estimates to correct answers, or comparing predictions, we might also say, right, to correct answers. So basically, the output of the model we compare to correct answers. And of course, that is correct. And so unsupervised learning doesn't. It compares to some other function that needs to be defined without having a correct answer to measure against.
So the correct answer there, see, you know what? We've got an awesome group of people paying attention, because every single person that answered got that right. Yeah.
Fantastic, folks.
All right. Moving on to question two. Question two, what is the role of the cost function in supervised learning? Is it A, to maximize the cost so the objective is reached? Is it B, to calculate cost by comparing estimates to the correct answers? Or C, to update model parameters?
All right, let's go with to maximize the cost so that the objective is reached. No, we don't want to maximize the cost. How about jumping to C? Is it to update model parameters? No, it's not exactly the cost function's job to do the updating. So does the cost function calculate the cost by comparing our estimates to correct answers? And of course, the answer is yes, it does. It gives us the cost, hence the name cost function.
Right, cool. And that's an interesting thing. So the cost function is also known as something else, right?
The we're talking about the error, the loss function.
No, that's fine. Like the objective.
Oh, there we go. Yes, the objective, sure.
Yeah.
Yes, it is our objective. Fair enough.
Cool, I think, oh, did I do something wrong?
There's a lot of terms.
Yeah, like
got me out of left field there.
Yeah. All right.
All the jargon gets us off. But by the way, our audience participants did an amazing job there as well. I think it was something like 87% correct on that one. So bravo. Cool. Not 100%, but still a bravo.
Yeah. And if you have any questions, keep them coming through as well while we go through it. Excellent. It sounds like we're going to move on to looking at gradient descent, which is a very, very interesting topic.
Yes. So this is the part where we're going to, you know, get into actually updating our parameters. So it is the job of our optimizer to update the parameters, and it needs to know how to do that. So when we get a wrong answer, we want to move towards the right answer. In other words, we get a set of wrong answers. In other words, we get a large cost. Then we want to take that large cost and run again with different parameters that'll be better, not just a random selection of different parameters, but better parameters. So the way we do that is using calculus and a process called gradient descent. And let me get my laser pointer back at work here. And let's suppose that this was our random first starting point. Now, notice too, Glenn, what do we got mapped here? What are the two axes on my graph before I actually get started? Because it's not my input parameter to my output anymore. That's not what I'm graphing.
No, we're actually looking at the parameters that have been trained or during the training. So the bottom axis is looking at the model parameters. So as we're supplying values, we want to see what the cost function is. And the y-axis is really the cost here. So we're measuring how much of a cost that particular parameter value is. And it looks like we're actually just comparing the values there. We're trying to find the minimal cost, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, exactly. So here, this isn't like our input from our data. This is our parameter. So like our intercept or our slope, and how badly, and then we're charting how badly it does against all the data. So if I set my slope to 5, then run all my data through it, what was the average cost? Is what we're checking. And then we're checking it for, and then we're saying, okay, well, if we checked it for a large amount of values. Now, here's the rub. We can only check one of these at a time. And if we have a giant data set, each run through our training data, what we call an epoch, each run through, more jargon, each run through our training data could take a very long time. So we don't get the benefit most of the time of seeing what the whole picture looks like laid out before us when we change our parameters. Plus, if we have 1,000 parameters, there's not really a good way to visualize a 1,000-dimensional graph. So, all right, let's focus on one parameter now. Like this is, say, our slope or our intercept, and we started off here. Now, what happens is we learn the cost function, but thanks to knowing what the actual function that we used was, what our mx plus b values were, and thanks to calculus, and we don't really need to know a lot of calculus here. We don't really need to know any calculus, but what you do need to know is that for basic algorithms or basic equations, there are well-known basic derivatives. A derivative just means the slope of that equation. So we know what our mx plus b is. We can do a very, very simple process to find out what the slope of that value is. And by doing that, and we'll show you the code, it's not intimidating, I promise. This is going to give us the slope here. And it's going to tell us that we're actually going down to the left. We want to go down to go down, we want to go to the left. And so that's exactly what our gradient descent would tell our parameters to do. It would say, update your parameters by such and such an amount. And that's exactly what we're doing. We go and do it again, and we do it again. Now, gradient descent gets about here, and it says, update your parameters this way, and that works, and we're at this low point, but we don't know that yet. Remember, we don't get to see the whole picture. And so when we update our parameters again, maybe we're like actually not at the very lowest point, maybe we're right here, and it tells us to go here. So it tells us to go here, and we realize, oh, we're actually got a worse cost than last time. This is worse. And therefore, we stop. We say, nope, we're going to stick with that better value we had. Now, this is a very simplified version of gradient descent. This is actually the gradient descent algorithm. There are some more advanced variations of gradient descent, but essentially all of our optimization algorithms derive from gradient descent. They're just advancements on this basic algorithm.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because when you look at that chart, I mean, we can see the chart of all the lines, but the optimizer really wouldn't be able to. They would just see a point in time go, you know, I think the value is lower, let's go to the left. And until we get to a point where it's not, and then we can correct and then hover in on what we think the right answer is, where it's got the lowest cost.
Yeah, it can see the slope of the cost, but for a given point, it can say it knows it's here, so it knows what the cost is, and it knows the angle, but it doesn't know how quickly the angle is going to swoop. For at any given point, the rest of this function could look like that. It doesn't know. It only knows the slope at the point it's at. Which of course, which is the nature of calculus. Again, you won't need to know anything about calculus other than how, for at least for these exercises, other than how to apply the basic algorithms that match up with basic equations, and we'll give those to you. But there are some limitations, Glenn.
Yeah, and we'll certainly see them in the next shot. But you can see that on the screen there as well. It looks like, if I had a cost function like you were talking about before, where we showed the other chart, and I kept going to the left here, on the chart on the right, for example, if I started to hover down that lower cost point and then started going to the left, it would actually want to go back to the right where it found that, I would say, local minima for
right.
that,
yes,
for that exactly. model parameter. And but there's actually a better value. That seems problematic. Why is
correct.
That?
Yes. And this is a real problem. And it's a real problem, especially if you don't have very many features. If you have a lot more input features, remember, a feature is essentially like a column, if you will, or a property. Okay, so it's the boot size, it's the t-shirt width, it's the shoulder width of the t-shirt, it's our year in our example. It's the input, right? So a feature is a property, a column, an input, and the more of them you have, the less likely we're to run into these sorts of things. But it's still a possibility to run into these local minima that prevent you from getting to the best value. There are mitigations, which we'll talk about very, very shortly. But first, let me show you one other problem that can occur and then talk about the balance of those mitigations.
And you know what? Mika in the chat window has just asked a question, which I think is perfect for this slide, is that is there a trade-off between optimizers between things like speed and accuracy?
Absolutely. In fact, optimizers themselves, yes, though we're not going to really dive into different types of optimizers or the variations in the optimization algorithm. But the short answer is yes, there is. But even more to that point, there is some trade-off even in what we can easily tweak, which is actually what I'm going to talk about right this second. And so the answer is yes on both counts. The other problem we can run into with a gradient descent is this divergence that can happen. So if we again just suppose that we started at this point and our algorithm tells us to go down, our gradient descent tells us that we need to move to the left. But if we're moving to the left by too large an amount, and this gets into something called learning rate, what we do is we actually take our slope, our derivative, and we multiply it by some value to decide how fast we're going to move. This goes back to the question that was just asked, is how fast do we converge? How fast do we get to the best option? Now, we can control that a little bit with something called learning rate. But if we have too big of a learning rate, look what happens. My gradient descent tells me I'm here and I should go to the left. My model parameter should be a lower number, but I decide to make it too big. I jump by too big of an amount. And when I do that, I actually am in a worse spot. Here's what happens. Because I'm in now an even higher gradient, a higher slope, if you will, right? Now it's going to jump again back to the right by even more because it uses that slope as well as our learning rate to decide how much. Learning rate's a number we control. The slope is just dictated by the algorithm. So those two things together decide how much we jump. And you can see when we set that learning rate real high, we jumped now again too much. And so now we're doing what we call diverging. We're actually getting worse and worse every time. And eventually we'll get to a point where this is no longer a problem. It'll start to flatten out. And so now maybe here we get to this point and then it still converges. It just converges pretty high up and in a not very optimal value. Whereas at some point, if you look through your training history, you'll say, hey, at some point it was this good, but it settled out up here. This is where it settled. Now that divergence problem, and actually, it can get worse if you have complicated shapes. Say it was diverging right here, then it would just go out. These problems we talked about, the divergence, as well as the local optima problem, can be mitigated by tweaking our learning rate, but towards different effects. This happened when we had too big of a learning rate because we were jumping too high. However, a large learning rate can actually help us jump over the local optima problem. You can see that here, we could have ended up in a local optima if we had a small learning rate, but with a large learning rate, it hopped over subtle, slight, irrelevant differences, basically things that might have just been variance in our input data. It did a better job dealing with that variance in our input data.
Right.
So learning rate size too is a thing that we have to experiment with. There's no perfectly right answer. Anything to add before we get you back into code, Glenn?
No, I think that's fairly spot on. So we're going to jump into our last exercise, which is to look at gradient descent in a little bit more action. So there's a few more steps here, but essentially we're loading the data, we're preparing our model, we'll go through the intercept and slope and see where we can see the gradient descent in action and try and essentially make a better fit for it and have a look visually with some charts about how that might work.
Awesome.
Let me share my screen. And I'll just move the window with you out of the way. So we're going to look at this gradient descent. So I might I might just go through the process again. So essentially, we're going to again use pandas to load that data and work with it. And in this case here, we've got a few things that are going on. We've got to remove the entries from July. And this is because of really the temperature in your part of the world, Jason, where it gets cold.
Yes.
from that chunk of time. So here we've got the month is left less than seven. So essentially January through to June. And
yeah. Now, is this a right thing to do? That this, of course, you know, is an interesting question. We know that we know for sure that in our given our business constraints, we won't do anything after July. So one could argue that we don't want our data to be confused by variants that might happen in, say, September. If there's some weird variants in there, we don't want that to mess up our data. You know, on the other hand, we're throwing away good, reliable data. So it's, again, a thing we'd want to experiment with. I wouldn't want to just assume throwing away the last 6 months of every year is a good way to handle
it. Yeah, I'm a big fan of more data, especially more quality data where we can. All right, so let's go ahead and run this cell. So we're also setting up another column here for the year, which is essentially taking that midpoint through the year as well. And then we're charting that. Once the data is available and processed.
Yep, we're working it.
Yeah, there we are.
Just beautiful.
So here we've got the temperature over time in Fahrenheit from 1950 all the way to 2017. Cool. And like it says here, it's a visual check. So we're wanting to look at the shape of the data quite often and visibly graph it where we can. Especially it's a lot easier when you've just got two axes though as well. All right, so let's fit a line to this data using the existing library that we used in last week's session, which is just using that ordinary least squares. And we'll do that just to get a sense of what the data should be. It's a comparison at this stage. We're not doing the involved training like we had been in the two previous exercises. But you can see here we've got the slope and the intercept, which is at 0.063. That's the slope, and the intercept is minus 83 in Fahrenheit. I always have to do math in my head when I'm converting to Celsius.
We will actually go through it and you know, train it ourselves again, and even be using our own optimizer this time. But one thing we actually are going to do with this is we wanted to get a baseline. So we use this other library to get a baseline of what is the right answer and where is it going to be centered around. And that's because, just for teaching purposes, We're going to hack some data in there and get a visual of that error function. So go ahead and do that for us, if you would, Glenn.
Excellent. So we've already gone ahead and run that cell, I believe. Yeah, that's fine. That's our data at the end. And then it's a matter of essentially updating the model class here. So we have that model class very similar to what we created before. There's an additional method here called getSummary, which just updates the display, or we'll use that to update the display showing the slope and intercept while we're training. It's really for our own benefit anyway. So I've run that. That's really just defining the class.
I see that my visualization didn't come up yet. Darn.
Oh, okay.
Where did my visualization go?
It'll be there soon. Yeah. Yay. Here we go. So then we're going to fit the model with gradient descent. So essentially it's going to take us through that process you showed us before, where we're going to look at the value, compare where we should be based on the slope, and then adjust our values to try and see if we can get the smallest cost value we possibly can. So I might get you to explain this process, Jason. So
if you wouldn't mind running it while I start explaining, because we're actually gonna look back down. Remember we used the library a minute ago and got the correct answers? Well, now we're going to center around those correct answers, but get a bunch of other values for our parameters. Now, the way that this is not how we do training in the real world, but we're going to be demonstrating and getting a view of that error function for our own sake. So what we did is we got the correct values, and then this NP lin space that you see twice right there, that is just creating a bunch of other values in the neighborhood of what the correct values were up there. That's going to then allow us to see both the best option and its neighboring options. And then essentially we use a cost function and predicting calc the same way we would in training. The only difference is instead of having an optimizer tell us what our next parameter is, we're just going to keep going back to this list that we hard coded, that we hard coded with the linear space there.
Awesome.
And what that's going to do is then give us something that we can graph in terms of all of the different errors that we got. And I think that should be showing up at the bottom now, that graph that we have.
There we are.
For a second, it didn't show up. Oh, I was nervous.
Yeah, I think it was waiting for me to scroll just a little bit. That's fine. So we've got that surface, and it's showing a few axes here. We've got the model intercept, the model slope, and also the cost. So one of the nice things about this chart is I can actually rotate it. And we can see that, yeah, it's pretty neat. And then if I look down here towards the bottom value, this is probably where the cost is going to be minimized, somewhere about here.
Yeah. One of the nice things about this graph too is if you notice actually the right hand guide or key, it shows us that as we get to that darker color, that's actually a lower value. So instead of trying to look at cost and the shape, if you kind of give us a dimension where cost is the z-axis, if you're able to do that. I know sometimes spinning that thing can be a little difficult, but if you're able to, almost there.
Yeah, it gets a little tricky, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is a little tricky. Well, what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that we can go along the intercept axis, and we can go along the slope axis, and we can find the different values that we tried. And we can see that if we had started, say, somewhere in the orange area, then our slope would start telling us that we should move a little bit towards the center, a little bit towards the center, a little bit towards the center. And that is exactly what our gradient descent is going to do. It's going to get that error function, find out what the slope is given the inputs, and then move us along.
Awesome.
So that's what we're doing, except our gradient descent process doesn't have the benefit of knowing the correct answer in advance and then centering around it like we did. That's why we cheated a little bit. Cool. So we could show you that cool graph.
All right. So that's a look at the graph. Let's actually go ahead and calculate some gradients. So we're doing some calculus here where we're looking at the slope, right? Let me run this if you want to speak to it, Jason.
Yeah, and remember I said it wouldn't be intimidating. Now, knowing how to do things like actually explain and justify the derivatives of functions is some challenging stuff. However, applying it to certain functions like this is not bad at all. What we have actually, since we used our mean squared error, the derivative of the overall error is actually just going to be it times two, and then using a couple well-known calculus functions, we're able to kind of pull out the individual components. And so you can see that the input to this function is the errors for each record. And so we mean that. We're basically getting the average of all those errors. For the slope, we multiply it by all of the inputs and match their errors. And we get what should be the update for that. So now we have, with that, we have those slopes.
Right. And we're going to use – sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you there, Jason.
Yeah, I think we were probably about to say the same thing, which is that the only thing now that we need is to take the slopes at the slope update and the intercept update, multiply it by whatever learning rate we've picked, and then we can update our parameter and try to train again.
Awesome. So I'm going to run this cell, which is actually going to do that loop. It's actually very similar to what we did before, but this time we're using the gradient descent to actually try and find the better cost function value that we're working with. And if I scroll down here, you can see that over time, we can see the costs just shrink down, like from 15,000 all the way down to about 60 towards the end.
Let me call out one thing really quick, since we did have some questions on normalization earlier. One of the, if you scroll up just a little bit, Glenn, y'all notice that we're actually cheating here and only updating slope. The reason is because our our magnitudes are very different. We didn't normalize this model. So if you see the actual values we're dealing with very small decimals and then a very large integer number. So it would take a long time to converge. It's actually not a bad exercise. If you guys want to take it away, if you all want to take it away, do the normalization like we did in exercise one. Apply that to this data set, and you can do that right here in this Jupyter Notebook, right here in the Learn interface. Apply that, and then also update your intercept parameter. It's just a few added lines of code. It'll take some thinking to figure out exactly how those lines of code should be, but it's a few lines of code. It's a great exercise to take away home because it is something you can do with just what we've taught in this class.
Awesome. Cool. So let's go ahead and run this gradient descent again. So it found the right answer, and we want to be able to run that with a different number of iterations and a different learning rate as well. So it took a bunch of loops really to get to that point. In this case, it was 1,000 iterations. You can see we've increased our learning rate and only are doing 20% of the iterations from before. And it roughly is getting to a very similar answer. If we look at that, 60.32 is the cost, 60.317 as the cost here.
So actually slightly better.
Slightly better, right? Yeah.
So that was by increasing the learning rate. So in other words, bigger jumps got us to the better answer faster, which sort of makes sense.
Right.
But
so let's change that. We'll increase it even more. And now our cost is infinity. That doesn't seem like it's a better answer,
that's
Jason.
That's probably not helpful, is it? So okay. we have a very large learning rate here. Our jumps got so big that we really couldn't surf the curve of the cost function anymore. We just started leaping over the whole graph.
Right. So it pays really to experiment with what the learning rate should be, right?
That's right.
Cool. So anything else to add on this exercise, Jason? I know we're tight on time.
I think that's it. Yeah, we're starting to get pretty close here, aren't we?
We are.
All right. Let's do our final knowledge check then, shall we? Oh, wait. We want to tell you all to go to aka.ms/learnlivetv again to answer questions yourself. Okay. Now you can ask.
All right. I'll ask away. So question three is, how does gradient descent know how to update the parameters? Does it compare the cost for a number of combinations of parameters and then selects the best one? Does it use an internal understanding of the relationship between features and labels to make intelligent choices? Or does it use calculus to estimate the slope of the cost function?
Well, does it compare costs for several combinations of the parameters and then select the best option? This actually is something that could theoretically work, but it's certainly not going to be efficient. Does it use an internal understanding of the relationship between features and labels? I hope not. If we have an internal understanding that's not well-defined by the math, we're in trouble. So does it use calculus to estimate the slope? The answer is absolutely yes.
Cool.
How'd we do in the world? We got
100%. Well, 100% so far, yeah. That's right. There's a slight delay. But I think when calculus comes up, people go, oh no, is it integration? Is it all that stuff? It's actually just looking at the slope. For the most part, it's actually the least difficult part of calculus in my experience.
It is. It absolutely is. Yes. So far. Yeah. So far.
All right.
Deep learning calculus gets a little scary sometimes.
Cool. And looking at the numbers, yeah, most people got that one right as well. Awesome. All right. Question four. Why are there many cost functions available? Is it A, unique cost functions required for each process currency or banking system? B, because cost functions help models process data and many model types are available? Or is it C, because different cost functions can arrive at different answers and what is best depends really on a goal? Ooh, I like this question. What do you think?
Well, it's definitely not true that unique cost functions required for currency is certainly not the case. That's for sure. I know we have the word cost in there. That's probably the bit, but it's definitely not the case. And it's not the case that we would need it for each domain or anything like that either. Cost functions may help, or because cost functions help models process data and many model types are available. That's not it. How about because different cost functions can arrive at different answers? And what is best depends. The classic answer, it depends.
Yeah, that's good. You know, and everyone who answered that at the time got that right as well. I think there was some people answering B as well, but B is not quite the right answer. There's
not quite. It's not as bad as A. I can understand B for sure.
Yeah.
Can understand that answer coming across.
I mean, there are lots of model types, but often the model types might use the same cost function, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Awesome. So I think good answer there. Lots of responses too, which is lovely. All right. Question five. I believe this is our last question.
It is.
Yeah. Why is learning rate important? Is it A, it speeds up or slows down training? B, if it's too large or too small, it can prevent a model from being trained optimally? Or is it C, both options are correct?
Well, does it speed up or slow down training? It sure can. If too large or too small, it can prevent a model from being trained optimally. Yep, it sure can. I think that means the correct answer is C.
Yeah.
Options are correct.
You know what? And everyone who's answering in the chat window agrees with you, Jason. So
well done, folks. Well done.
Good. Bit of crowdsourcing on that one. That's excellent. So I think that's a really good responses from everyone. Looks like everyone's paying attention, which is lovely as well. And let's move on because we're really just going to summarize what we've learned so far. And yeah, Jason, you want to take us through it?
Yeah, I'm gonna do this quickly because I'd love to have a chance to field a few questions from the folks out there. So we really did take our second pass at peeling the onion layers away at the big picture of machine learning on this one. We did a lot of the same things we did last time, but this time we implemented them ourselves. And we talked about why we were making those decisions or why those things were done that were kind of under the hood or abstracted from us in episode one. This is kind of our final episode on the very, very, very high level. After this, we're going to start digging into some more kind of detailed verticals where we're not going to keep doing that overall survey. And we're going to actually start with data next, which is not just training a model. With our data, we're going to be just looking at the raw data, slicing it, understanding it, building actually even intuitive models that aren't machine learning models, but are just as meaningful in terms of looking at understanding our data and providing business value. That's next week.
Awesome. And we've got a bit more after that, training and understanding regression models, refining and testing machine learning models, some other things which are probably too much to say right now, but certainly come back. Or if you're interested, look at the learning path link that we have on the top of the screen, the LearnML. That will take you to the complete path.
And awesome. Then for going through and doing this module that we did today, that we all did together today, but you want to do it by yourself, you want to take that challenge I offered about normalizing and retraining that last exercise, then go on over to aka.ms/learnml-classicalml.
For sure. Excellent. And I think we've got a few minutes for questions.
Maybe get a Jason. Couple in there if we have let's some folks with questions.
Oh, I love this question already. Could you use classic ML to do things like image recognition?
It's an interesting question. The technical answer is yes. And in fact, one of the most common demos that you'll see is to use classical ML to recognize handwritten numbers. This actually is also, fun fact, one of the first commercial uses of machine learning was to use the classic demo data set, this MNIST data set, which is black and white handwritten numbers. And yes, you can absolutely use classic ML. Quite a few different algorithms will work for it, as a matter of fact, to recognize handwritten digits. If you start getting into recognizing more elaborate type of images, you're definitely going to start to want to look at more complex machine learning architectures like deep learning architectures and CNN architectures. But for some purposes, it absolutely could be used.
Yeah, and just to add to that as well, I think for many situations, you might find some of the cognitive services that we offer also implement some of that functionality.
Yeah, that's a great point. Sometimes doing it yourself is the wrong answer, because there are a lot of boxed products, especially from Microsoft, especially in terms of our cognitive services and our applied AI, that will get you what you want just by signing up and making an API call.
Yeah. Like, just a reference here in Australia, I remember at the Microsoft office here, like a bunch of years ago, I created an app called What Snake Just Bit Me, because I had a data set of all these images from my friend who was a snake catcher. And I just took photos and trained the model just using the images. We had all the labels of what they were, similar to what we're doing in the supervised situation. And I was able to take another photo that wasn't trained and go what snake it was. And it was really accurate. There's some great services out there on Azure.
Thank you for giving us that authentic Australian flavor right there.
It's what I do. All right. So there's also another question. What courses should I take to get good at ML? Well, what got you good at ML, Jason?
Well, there's a lot of good content out there. I actually would focus on a couple things that are offered by Microsoft is what I'd like people to focus on. So if you go, actually, let me go ahead and maybe even share my screen for it. And if you look at our Microsoft.com website, the Machine Learning for Data Scientists has a lot of good content for using our Azure products, using our Azure products for doing machine learning. Now, if you're more interested in the concepts of machine learning, of course, the AKA that we've been throwing at you this whole time is super important. The one that will take you to this learning path. And in addition to this learning path, there is linked some other options. Option two, option one, option three. We're going through this course with option two, but option one and option three are also great. And then finally, for some more kind of interesting scenarios that also play with deep learning and do some things like that, I have something offered by our amazing Cloud Advocate team, one of whom is actually working with us in the chat today, and that is this ML for beginners. So they go through using several libraries for both classic ML and deep learning. They do talk about data prep. It's very much complementary to the learning path that we're working with here.
Awesome. I think we've only got time for a couple more questions, and we have to be very quick with the answers here as well. Mika has a question. When we say classic ML, are we talking machine learning, not using Python ML libraries like sklearn? I think we're talking about the classical techniques, really, instead of the libraries there, Mika.
Yeah, sklearn typically does use classic algorithms. So scikit-learn and most of the techniques that we would use with scikit-learn would come under the heading of classical ML. Absolutely.
Awesome.
But so, less so things like PyTorch.
Right. So we have about 1 minute left. So we might have to, hopefully the moderators can answer the other questions in the chat. But we'll just move to the last slide and say a fond farewell for now. And thanks everyone for attending this session. We're hoping you'll come back for the next seven sessions that we have in the series. We hope you've learned a lot. I can see a comment from Nate. Thank you, Jason, Glenn. We appreciate you sticking around, Nate. And we hope to, again, see you real soon. Bye for now.
Bye, folks.